Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, several reports from the Ohio State House News Bureau. One, the debate of arming educators after the Sandy Hook Elementary School tragedy. And then something a little lighter, selling Tupperware is a drag for one man in Ohio. We'll hear about that. Politics Ohio and Poor Will's Almanac coming up in today's program. Up first, the movie Lincoln, depicting the drama surrounding the passage of the 13th Amendment, is receiving Oscar buzz, particularly for its star, Daniel Day-Lewis. But months before the amendment abolishing slavery was adopted in 1865, a Dayton man declared his own independence. Community Voices producer Amelia Robinson interviewed descendants of Jordan and Amanda Andersons last summer.
Before dying of exhaustion in 1905, Jordan Anderson was a janitor, coachman, laborer in Saxton. But the man who raised a family on Burns Avenue started life around 1825 as a slave on Colonel P.H. Anderson's plantation in Big Spring, Tennessee. With his wife Amanda and children, Jordan fled the plantation in a hell of gunfire. He was not willing to return despite his former master's insistence that things would be better if he came back.
This is a letter from a free man to his old master, written just as he dictated it. Dayton, Ohio, August the 7th, 1865. To my old master, Colonel P.H. Anderson, Big Spring, Tennessee. Sir, I got your letter and was glad to find that you had not forgotten Jordan and that you wanted me to come back and live with you again, promising to do better for me than anybody else can.
107 years after he was buried in Dayton's Woodland Cemetery, and months after he became an internet sensation, Jordan Anderson's great-great-grandson, Jule Wilson Jr., heard the words he sent to the man who used to call him property.
We trust the good maker has opened your eyes to the wrongs which you and your fathers have done to me and my fathers in making us toil for you for generations without recompense. Here I draw my wages every Saturday night, but in Tennessee there was never any payday for the Negroes any more than for the horses and cows. Surely there will be a day of reckoning for those who defraud the laborer of his hire.
The letter touched Jew Jr.
Yeah, see, why are you crying? Just because it was so emotional for you? Or
heritage is family, you know. You never know that's where you came from.
Jordan made news here and abroad after the media discovered his fiery letter rejecting the colonel's offer. His great-great-granddaughter, Janet Jordan, and the rest of the family happily took it all in.
And then another story says, what's amazing is that the current living relatives of Colonel Anderson are still angry at Jordan for not coming back. Knowing that the plantation was in serious disrepair after the war, said Winbush, director of the Institute for Urban Research at Maryland's Morgan State University. I guess the usual lame line of get over it doesn't apply to these idiots. Something, they're still angry that Jordan didn't come back. Evidently, he was in great demand. He must have been a very good worker, very smart. That explains it if they're still angry, even now.
The story was not new to Jule Wilson Sr., that's Janet's uncle, and Jule Jr.'s dad. Jule heard all about it and his family's flight from slavery from his grandma, Jane, the only descendant of Jordan and Amanda Andersons thought to have had children of her own.
There, and they would always bring in different things and tell us. And they would tell us everything.
What do you think about that as a little kid?
I think that's just wonderful. It's amazing. But like I was telling my son a while ago, there's nothing impossible with God. God was in the plant all the time.
And tell me, there's a street called Anderson, right?
Yes, Anderson. Right there, if you pass UD, and guess what about that street? One thing about that street, that's where I was born on Anderson.
The Dayton Library's research department received a ton of calls after the story hit the Huffington Post and other news outlets. Local attorney Michael Birch, genealogist in his spare time, did his own research. The result was a nearly 60-page report detailing the Andersons' family history.
The information in the letter is substantiated by historical and genealogical records. The references to people and that sort of stuff. Everybody he mentioned in this letter existed. The only people that I could not find were the first two daughters. The first couple of daughters may have been mistreated down the South Plantation before he left, because he refers to a couple of daughters that there's no documentation up here in Ohio.
In answering this letter, please state if there would be any safety for my Millie and Jane, who are now grown up and both good-looking girls. You know how it was with poor Matilda and Catherine. I would rather stay here and starve and die, if it come to that, than have my girls brought to shame by the violence and wickedness of their young masters.
You think he was angry, or you think he was trying to get back at him, or just like matter of fact?
I think he was probably upset, but actually the letter doesn't have an angry tone in it. I don't think it does. I think the letter is kind of entertaining, and there's a lot of speculation about who actually wrote the letter. Did he write this letter? And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, his friend Valentine Winters, who is connected with the bank here, probably helped him out with it. My memory is right. The census reports indicate that he really couldn't write, but that doesn't make any difference. I mean, you can't think. So I think a lot of these ideas and certainly all the facts would have come from him.
As to my freedom, which you say I can have, there is nothing to be gained on that score, as I got my free papers in 1864 from the Provost Marshal General of the Department of Nashville. Mandy says she would be afraid to go back without some proof that you were disposed to treat us justly and kindly, and we have concluded to test your sincerity by asking you to send us our wages for the time we served you. This will make us forget and forgive old scores and rely on your justice and friendship in the future. I served you faithfully for 32 years and Mandy 20 years. At $25 a month for me and $2 a week for Mandy, our earnings would amount to $11,680. Add to this the interest for the time our wages have been kept back, and deduct what you paid for our clothing and three doctor visits to me and pulling a tooth for Mandy, and the balance will show what we are in justice entitled to. Please send the money by Adams Express in care of V. Winters, Esquire, 267, Dayton, Ohio. If you fail to pay us for faithful labors in the past, we can have little faith in your promises in the future.
It's really a good letter. It's very entertaining. It references some historical information that is backed up, and it puts things in context. The references as to how he and his family were treated are kind of subtle in this. It doesn't come across as an angry way. It comes across a little bit in a pleasantly sarcastic way, as if he's amused by the fact that this master actually thought he might be able to induce him to come back down. I think he probably told Valentine Winters and some other people that he was aware of and was friends with, and they probably were thinking the same thing he was thinking. How could a guy really have the gall to ask me to come back down to that?
Burge was fascinated by the letter's honesty.
He looked forward to what he was going to see in the future for himself and his family up here. One of the things he refers to in his letter is education for his kids.
By all accounts, the Andersons found success in Dayton.
I want to know particularly what the good chance is you propose to give me. I am doing tolerably well here. I get $25 a month with victuals and clothing. Have a comfortable home for Mandy. The 266 folks called her Miss Anderson. And the children, Millie, Jane, and Grundy, go to school and are learning well.
I read the letter not so much as propaganda, but just more as a kind of a sarcastic response to somebody that's finally out of that. And he knows he never has to go back because he got his freedom before he ever got this letter. And he refers to that fact. I'm not coming back. You know, you don't need to set me free. I'm already free. And I think that he got the letter, and I think he actually mailed it. And I think he had a lot of fun doing it.
Times are far from easy, but one of Jordan and Amanda's sons became a doctor, another a Buffalo soldier. Now singers, administrators, and pastors are counted among their many descendants. Take Jules Sr.'s daughter, Judith Novell, for example. Now, what do you do?
Well, I just graduated from Master's of Divinity from United Theological Seminary, getting ready to go for my doctorate. I retired from the government after 36 years. I'm like a freelance writer. I've just written a book. I like coordinating our family to come together to sing songs of praise. All our family have
done so many things, so many accomplishments, our family members. And I said, well, it started from then. And that's how we become who we are.
Judith says she read the letter long before realizing it was written by a relative. Do you think you would have had a different impression if you didn't know it was your family?
It would have been different because it's like, okay, now this is my blood, my flesh. So, yeah, it's a lot different. Mm-hmm. This was a man who loved God, loved his family, and I just felt great to be a part of the family.
Barry Wilson had one word for his great-great-grandfather's letter.
Awesome. Very, mm-hmm. very awesome. A letter for a black man at that time to have the courage to say what he felt mm-hmm. and what he felt he was owed and how he was treated.
The great desire of my life now is to give my children an education and have them from virtuous habits. Say howdy to George Carter and thank him for taking the pistol from you when you were shooting at me. From your old servant, Jordan Anderson.
When you hear that letter, what does it make you feel?
Pride.
Makes you feel pride?
Yeah, for someone way back there that had that much intelligence to write a letter like that. So he had to have learned what God gave it to him. He put it all in him to be able to talk like that or to write like that. And he had everything down to the penny. And so that meant he could also count. And he knew exactly what he was due. And he intended to get that if he was going to go back there to work for him. But I'm sure he would have never went back there.
This is Amelia Robinson reporting for WYSO's Community Voices Project.
And this year, WYSO is pleased to welcome a new crop of Community Voices producers. Make sure you stay tuned to WYSO Weekend for those entertaining and important stories. And you can find out more about the Community Voices Project on our website at WYSO.org. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for making us a part of your Sunday morning. Coming up, two stories from the Ohio State House News Bureau. First, of a more serious nature, the number of teachers who signed up to take advantage of a free training program offered by a gun rights group is growing, but there are still a lot of questions about the idea of arming teachers in schools. State House correspondent Karen Kassler has this report.
Teachers have been responding in a big way to the Armed Teacher Training Program, says Jim Irvine with the Buckeye Firearms Foundation.
The latest numbers just in are 759, over 700 of them in the state of Ohio.
Is that number a surprise to you?
It is. I expected several hundred people to respond to this, but not the response that we have gotten.
The classes in the Armed Teacher Training Program are still being developed, and there's no timeline on when they'd be offered yet. But Irvine says the gun rights group decided to offer the 3-day program to educators and school employees after the deadly shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut last month. And Irvine says it's time that districts re-examined gun-free zone policies because he says they leave teachers, administrators, school personnel, and of course students vulnerable.
Having a policy that helps someone achieve a high body count is a bad idea. It's a failed policy, and we need to get rid of that and put in place policies that actually work to lower our body count.
Though hundreds have signed up for the training, there are more than 150,000 educators, school officials, and other school personnel in the state of Ohio. And that training wouldn't mean a teacher could carry a weapon into a school unless the district specifically authorized it. Damon Asbury with the Ohio School Boards Association says it's too early to tell whether districts want to go that way.
The conversation I've heard by and large is that, you know, just the arming teachers may not be the most effective or even safest way to go about providing security. There's lots of pros and cons, I'm sure, but, you know, we've had school shootings in settings where there have been armed guards.
But Patricia Frost Brooks with the state's largest teachers union, the Ohio Education Association, says teachers should not be forced into what she calls a dual role.
We aren't going to be there to be armed and carry a weapon and then, you know, be the academic leaders and do the teaching and preparing students for this 21st century skills.
The attorney general has said he supports having someone with experience and training posted in a school who has access to a gun. And for now, Mike DeWine is talking up training his office is offering starting next week for school employees on how to prepare for, to stop, and to deal with a school shooting situation.
I think it really comes back to what that local school wants to do. And I think the courses that we are offering, frankly, are going to help that school better understand the nature of the threat. I think once they get that information, they're going to be in a better position to make, as a community, a decision about whether they want someone actually in that school who has a gun, who has been trained.
Meanwhile, DeWine says there are still about 50 schools out of around 5,000 that have not provided his office with floor plans for their buildings and required emergency safety plans. The AG's office contacted those schools which had not complied after last year's shooting in Chardon, and then again after last month's tragedy in Connecticut. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
And now some lighter fare on Why So Weekend. A struggling actor in Los Angeles has made a name for himself here in Ohio, and he's done that by parlaying his acting skills into a sales career for a product that's been around for decades. Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles has the report.
It wasn't too long ago that Kevin Farrell was living in Los Angeles, playing small parts as an actor on TV, like this one in the hit show Frasier. He played the part of Rodney, a man who looks and acts like Niles, one of the show's main characters.
It doesn't remind you of anyone?
Remind me of anyone? So sorry, but about my coffee, I neglected to mention that I like my milk steamed, but just a dollop of foam, such as might give the effect of a cumulus cloud reflected in a still pond.
Consider it done. I want to kill myself.
But in recent years, Farrell says he went to auditions where he found himself going for the same parts as famous actor Nathan Lane. He says that's when he knew he needed to make a change. The change he made is to a career in an industry popularized in the movie The Graduate.
Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Farrell decided to use his acting skills to sell plastic containers that can be found in many homes. Tupperware. But he doesn't sell it by merely going into homes to demonstrate the products. Farrell sells it by using his acting skills.
Well, I do my party as a character. My character's name is DWI, and she's a little trailer trash Southern belle from Tennessee. So I actually dress up as a woman. So that's how I sell my Tupperware, is in drag, and I play a character. And girls just clamor to have me come to their house to do parties because it's different. It's different than any kind of in-home party that you would normally get invited to. So I think that's why I'm so successful.
No, honey, you cannot.
At this home party in Southern Delaware County, Farrell, or DWI, clearly has the attention of the 30 women in attendance. And that's evident when he gives the crowd instructions about the order forms.
If you're drinking heavily, yes, and we know who we are, fill it out now. So that when I get home to the trailer, I can read your drunken handwriting. So name.
Farrell demonstrates many uses for Tupperware. And he comes up with a few of his own, like using a large Tupperware cup to disguise a can of beer that he jokes women at this party could take to their children's soccer games.
Grab yourself your Bud Light can. Top the top and drop it in. You run your straw into the top of your Bud Light can. And then no one knows we've got our little Budweiser at the soccer field.
Farrell's Tupperware show is full of twists and turns, and at one point, he breaks out in song.
Leftovers will heat and serve so easy, you will find that life with your
Farrell's
Tupperware.
Audience is primarily women, and they love his show. Julie Greenwald is one of the ladies at this one.
He was fantastic. I learned more about Tupperware than I thought I would. I'm buying more than I thought I would. But it was a lot of fun. I was excited to come. I'm glad I did. I want to go to another one.
If you think this is just a little side business for Farrell, think again.
Yeah, actually, I have held the title as the number one seller in the U.S. and Canada for 4 years in a row.
Farrell says it's not uncommon to sell $4,000 worth of plastic containers in just one show, and he does several shows each week. He's moved from California to his native Ohio, where he's purchased a new home away from what he calls the rat race. And he has a contingency plan to face the sometimes brutally cold Ohio weather.
You know, if it seems that I can't stand the Ohio winters, I'm going to pack my Tupperware bag and I'm going to head to Southern California for 2 months, and I'll just book a bunch of parties when I'm out there.
But for now, Farrell is busy working and living here in Ohio, selling one of the world's oldest plastic products in a new way. Joe Ingles at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
Now from plastics, we move on to the natural world. Here's what's happening.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the first week of deep winter. I had been reading predictions about the end of the world, and the occasion was the alignment of this past December's solstice with the galactic equator, a once-in-26,000-years event foretold by the ancient Mayans. All that foolishness, along with the longest nights of the year, had somehow set me off balance, and I decided to go and see for myself what was happening in the real world of the woods. I walked along the river, and the water was higher than it had been in months. Garlic mustard was growing up beside osage fruits that had been shredded by squirrels. Henbit and sweet rockets and wild onions, ragwort and hemlock and leafcup foliage pushed out from between the mossy trunks of fallen trees. In the muck of the swamp, skunk cabbage was set for March. And all around me, soft green mounds of mouse-eared chickweed were rising through layers of the last honeysuckle leaves, through the crumbling strata of summer and fall, along the bottomland and up the wooded talus slopes. Encouraged by this year's gentle autumn, the mouse-eared chickweed rose tightly and firmly around the other precocious weeds, binding and linking them, leading them in forecast for a new year. Glowing in the late sun, their small, bold leaves seemed to me a bright banner of hope spreading through the forest and a fresh antidote to apocalypse. Indeed, I saw there truly was a great convergence in the making, although not the one the Mayans had in mind. For the mouse-eared chickweed, the garlic mustard, the ragwort, the sweet rocket, the henbit, the moss, the skunk cabbage, the hemlock, and the wild onions, they were aligned as plainly as any galactic objects could ever be. earth stars shining day and night across the winter to come. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of deep winter. In the meantime, relax. The world did not end, and everything is in perfect alignment.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. It's the start of a new year at the Ohio State House, and I'm joined today with Bill Cohen from Ohio State House News Bureau to talk with me about what's ahead. Thanks for being here today.
Sure.
Let's start with Governor Kasich's plan. He wants to impose a tax on oil and gas drillers. Kasich this week warned them that if they continue to encourage legislators to block the proposal, it could be even more problematic for them in the future. Is Kasich going to be able to pass that legislation?
Well, he's had it in front of state legislators for more than a year, and even though he's a Republican and Republicans control both the House and Senate, he has not been able to get either chamber to pass his proposal or even give it committee hearings. They seem to be, at least the majority Republicans, seem to be agreeing so far with what the oil and gas industry says, which is basically, heck, if you want to increase the severance tax on oil and gas drilling that uses fracking, horizontal fracking, then we may just pick up our rigs and move elsewhere. So you better not increase our taxes at all. In general, that's what the majority Republicans seem to be saying, at least over the past year, although recently a couple of the Republican legislative leaders predicted that in the coming year, legislators will indeed okay some form of the governor's tax shift plan.
So if it's not approved, what would happen then?
The governor has been raising the specter of some liberal group perhaps going out on the streets, collecting hundreds of thousands of petition signatures, and putting an even bigger tax increase on the drillers on the ballot. Now, we went to one of the main groups that actually has its own tax hike plan on drillers. That's Innovation Ohio. And we said to them, well, are you planning some kind of a ballot issue? And they basically said, not at the moment. But they have been strongly pushing their own plan that would hike taxes on oil and gas drillers much more than what Kasich has proposed. And then there's another big difference between the governor's plan and the proposal from Innovation Ohio. The governor wants to use any revenue that the tax hike would bring in. He wants to use all of that money to pay for an income tax cut. Innovation Ohio says that would mostly just help the wealthy because, after all, they pay most of the state income tax. Instead, let's send a lot of the money to cities and schools around the state. They need the money badly because they were cut badly with state budget cuts a year or two ago. So let's give them the money so they can restore their workforces.
Let's talk about the state budget. What can we expect this year?
Well, the money over the last couple years has been coming in, tax revenue has been coming in pretty much as budget officials have projected. So at least at the moment, we don't have any big budget shortfall looming, as we did have a couple 3 and 4 years ago. So I think the big question is, will there be surplus state money building up? If there is surplus money coming in, what should we do with it? Of course, the governor says if there is surplus money, we should probably give it back to taxpayers in the form of an income tax cut. Others might say, no, let's use any money that comes in extra and build up the rainy day fund even more. And then you have groups on the left who are basically been saying if there's any surplus state money coming in over the next couple of years, let's spend it. Let's give it to schools, let's give it to cities, and let's give it to government programs for the most vulnerable.
Are we likely to see the return of any social issues to the state house? The heartbeat bill, for example, seemed like it wasn't going anywhere at the end of 2012. Is that going to stay that way?
I think the heartbeat bill may very well come back. That's the bill that says if there's a fetal heartbeat after 6, 7, or 8, 9 weeks, then no abortion. The House passed that late last year. The Senate decided to block it, so it didn't become law, but that could very well come back. There was another loosening of restrictions on concealed carry that one of the chambers passed, but in the end, it didn't get through last year, and that could come back again. There was yet another proposal to basically say to welfare recipients, we're going to give you drug tests, if you are found to have taken illegal drugs, maybe you won't get your public assistance. That's a proposal that majority Republicans in general seem to like, but it didn't get final passage last year, so that could come up again. And then I guess you've basically got the two-year state budget. That's the kind of the granddaddy of them all. There's all sorts of policy decisions that are tucked into that. That'll be the big focus of attention until June 30th. That's basically the deadline for them to pass a new two-year state budget.
I've been speaking with Bill Cohen from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks for being here, Bill.
Sure thing.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, the Book Month.